With a lot of stay-at-home or quarantine orders being lifted for some states, you may be feeling even more anxiety. I know that I am. So here's another reminder. There has been an increase in suicides during the pandemic. If you are experiencing suicidal thoughts, please call the National Suicide Hotline at 1-800-273-8255. There has also been a spike in domestic violence and child abuse. If you do not feel safe in quarantine, please call 1-800-799-SAFE or 7233. Or dial 911 and just leave the line open if that's all you can do. Remember, you are not alone. There are resources. Please reach out if you need help. I'll have international resources as well as these U.S. numbers in today's show notes. Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Poison has long been considered a woman's weapon. That's not really true. It's a pop culture myth, but one that makes sense as our most famous female killers of lore were poisoners. But that's from centuries before, when women had to use the weapons at hand. And back then, poison was much easier to get. And unless a killer racked up several victims, especially in their own family, it often went unnoticed. But actually, about 60% of poisoners are male, while 40% are female. But in earlier centuries, women got a lot of the press, which makes sense. We are supposedly the weaker sex, so a murderess will always dominate headlines. Publicity aside, it's not really a fair comparison either, considering men kill at a much higher rate than women anyway. And this is where poisoning gets even trickier. It's often undetected, especially in hospital settings. But there is one common variable. The poisoner always believes he is smarter than everyone else. He believes he won't get caught. And that hubris is usually his undoing. Welcome to episode 94, The Poisoner and the Undercover Detective. On Sunday, October 23rd, 1988, 41-year-old Peggy Carr was up before the sun. She had the morning shift at the diner she worked at in Alturas, Florida. She was a very petite and attractive woman with a short haircut, stylish for the time and for her age. Alturas is an unincorporated community in central Florida with a population of under 5,000 back in 2010. It was even smaller in the 80s, and Peggy lived with her family in the middle of an orange grove. Typically, I would give you a small history of a town, but there really isn't much to Alturas. It's just a very rural, small community in Polk County, Florida, mostly filled with orange trees and phosphate mines. Peggy had only recently remarried and moved to Alturas. It was her third marriage. She was born and grew up in a small farming community in Alabama. One of five children, both of her parents were deaf, so she had a unique upbringing, often acting as interpreter for her parents. Peggy lived with her new husband, Parolin Carr, known as Pi. Thank God, because I'm not sure I pronounced that correctly. Peggy had three children, but her oldest son, Alan, was stationed at a naval base in Tennessee. Her teenage son, Dwayne, and her daughter, Sissy, and granddaughter had come to live with her and Pi. Sissy was the oldest of Peggy's kids and worked with her at the diner. She and her two-year-old daughter, Casey, lived in a garage apartment at the Carr home. Pi also had two teenagers living there, Travis and Tammy. Tammy was the oldest, and at 18 years old, she had already been married and divorced. She had lived in the house with her mother, Margaret, and Pi. Then when they divorced, she and her mother lived there alone until Margaret moved out. Her ex-husband, Mark, also briefly lived there with Pi Carr, who was not really a fan of his son-in-law. But now Mark was gone, and Tammy was there with Pi, her younger brother Travis, her new stepmother, and her kids. Pi Carr was a phosphate miner, and described as a big, burly man with few words. With four teenagers in the house, as well as Sissy and a two-year-old, you might think of this blended family as a sort of Brady Bunch, but they were not. You have to remember, Peggy and Pye had only been married less than 6 months, so it was definitely an adjustment, and it was described as a very quarrelsome household. Peggy and Pye had recently been fighting, bad enough that he went to a motel for a night. Peggy thought he was already cheating on her, but they worked it out and he was back at home. And the teens, while not always getting along, were still teenagers. The family had a pool in the backyard where the teens would play, push each other in, splash and scream and yell like any other normal teenagers. The boys also had motorcycles that they rode all over the property and sometimes onto the next door neighbor's property. They only had one close neighboring house, and the couple living there were very different from the Carr family, and the boisterous teenagers got on their nerves. But on this warm October morning, when Peggy got to work around 6 a.m., her neighbors nor her recent marital problems were on her mind. Her shift started at 7, but she liked to get there early to be prepared, and according to the book Poison Mind, she liked to have a cup of coffee with her favorite customer before her shift. He was retired and came to the diner almost daily, and he had been a medic in the Army. Instead of joking around with him as usual, Peggy clutched at her chest and said, "I think I'm having a heart attack." He calmly said, "Give me your hand." Peggy's face and nails were pink, showing that she was still circulating blood well and her oxygen was normal. He took her pulse, which was also normal. He assured his favorite waitress that if he thought it was at all possible she was having a heart attack, he would drive her to the hospital himself. Peggy rose wanly at 7 o'clock and started her shift. Sissy, her daughter, was working the lunch shift. When she got to work, her mother would be getting off soon, and she was going to ask her to watch Casey when her shift was over until Sissy got home from work. Peggy agreed but told her daughter about her chest pains and said her hands were numb. She kept rubbing them together. Sissy felt her mother's hands and thought they were cold. Peggy also said that her legs ached terribly. Sissy made her sit down and rest and then got Peggy to go ahead and leave for the day. She came home to an empty house because Pye had been on a weekend hunting trip. Remember, this was a Sunday. Pye came home and found his wife on the couch, very weak and in terrible pain. But his sister was a nurse and often took care of the family, so he called her instead of taking Peggy to a doctor or hospital. His sister only lived a mile away, and she rushed over. She also didn't see any vital sign issues, except that Peggy's blood pressure seemed a tad high. Sissy got home from work around 9 p.m. that night, and her mother could barely move. Now she was pale and her lips were chapped. She couldn't even open her eyes. Peggy could barely whisper to her daughter how bad she hurt. Sissy went to Pye, who shrugged it off. "It's just a virus or something," he reportedly said. But a couple of hours later, he knocked on Sissy's apartment door and told her he was taking her mother to the hospital and asked her if she wanted to come. They drove to the nearest hospital in the city of Bartow. Pye tenderly carried his wife inside. She told him, "I feel like I'm on fire." She was in the hospital for 3 days, but the doctors couldn't figure out what was wrong with her, and she got pissed when one suggested her symptoms could be psychosomatic. Peggy had always been an outspoken spitfire, so this seemed like a good sign that she was showing some improvement. On the third day, she really seemed better. She was sitting up and eating, so doctors sent her home. But almost as soon as she got home, she got sicker. And so did her stepson Travis and her son Dwayne. Not as sick as Peggy, but with the same symptoms, tingling in their fingers and toes. They felt like they were burning all over and had upset stomachs. Pye's sister came back to check on all of them. Maybe it was the flu or some strange bug. She found a 6-pack of Coca-Colas in the kitchen and poured them all glasses. They needed fluids no matter what this ailment was. According to the book Poison Mind, The boys first even laughed it off as the longest hangover they had ever had because they had drank a lot the weekend before. Sissy was troubled, but went to work the next day. In the evening, Pi called her at work and said to meet him at the hospital. He had called an ambulance for her mother. Doctors were still perplexed, but a neurologist on call had a hunch. Peggy was awake, alert, and cooperative, but she could barely move. She writhed with pain if she was touched, and she had developed ulcers in her mouth. She kept saying it was like her feet were on fire, like she had walked on hot coals. Pi pulled the neurologist aside and said his son and stepson were also sick, though not as bad as Peggy. The doctor told him to get the boys in the hospital that day because he thought all of them might have been poisoned. He brought in an infectious disease specialist who looked over Peggy's case and suspected she had been poisoned with some sort of heavy metal like lead, mercury, or even arsenic, but these had not shown up on her regular blood tests. The neurologist was the one to say, "I think it's thallium." They both thought it seemed an unlikely drug, as you couldn't just buy it off the shelf. But that made the most sense for Peggy's symptoms. By now, Sissy had called her Aunt Shirley, who still lived in Alabama. She rushed to her sister's side. At this point, Peggy couldn't speak. But Shirley, like Peggy, knew sign language. She had also grown up acting as an interpreter for their deaf parents. And now she was the only one able to communicate with her sister, even if it was only a word or two. Peggy signed, "I hurt." Peggy's hair started falling out in clumps, and within another day, she was in the intensive care unit. When she was told she had been poisoned, she kept signing "Why" to her sister. "Why, why, why?" And then she slipped into a coma. She would never leave the ICU. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. After languishing and suffering for 4 months in the ICU, Peggy's children and Pi were finally told by her doctors that there was no hope she would ever awaken from the coma. She was a pitiful ghost of herself, with most of her hair gone and her muscles atrophied, unable to move or communicate at all. Pi signed his consent to remove his wife from life support. And then he, Peggy's sister Shirley, her daughter Sissy, and brother Alan, sobbing, watched as the life support was cut off and Peggy's heart line on the monitor went flat. I have to tell you, dear listeners, that after last week's case, the brutal rape and murder of a teenage girl, I chose this case thinking it would be less gruesome and maybe not quite as heartbreaking. But death by poisoning is an agonizing way to die. While Peggy's son and stepson did finally recover, Peggy had ingested too much of the poison. She suffered pitifully as her helpless sister, daughter, and husband watched. Peggy's doctors assured her family that though she was in a coma and already heavily medicated, they would push the morphine even higher as they removed life support, doing everything they could to make her last moments peaceful. When I read how Peggy passed away, I was crying. I recently lost my own mother, and this case got to me in a way that I didn't expect. I texted Haley, my research assistant, who immediately offered to switch cases. I was reading a book by one of the detectives, and she was doing all of the outside research. But I said no. I'm glad I feel a personal connection to victims and their families, no matter if it hits really close to home. And I think many people don't really understand the suffering of someone dying from poison. Movies and TV shows make it look as though you take a drink and either die on the spot or fall unconscious, soon to die in a hospital. You don't really see how it ravages the victim's body and how much pain they suffer before they die, and how their loved ones have to watch them waste away. And thallium is an even more sinister poison than we are used to reading about or seeing in pop culture. According to the CDC, thallium is tasteless and odorless, It's what makes it the perfect murder weapon. It's difficult to detect unless you are specifically looking for it in tests. Thallium is also used in some chemical reactions and medical procedures. In the past, thallium was used as a rodent poison, but it was banned in the early 70s because it was found that accidental exposure to thallium is toxic. In 1984, the United States stopped producing thallium, but it is still imported to make things like electronics, optical lenses, and imitation jewels. You can absorb thallium by inhalation, ingestion, and skin contact, so it is very carefully monitored. If you ingest thallium, the adverse effects don't usually start for 12 to 25 hours, and the symptoms reach their maximum in the second or third week after exposure. Nausea and vomiting are usually the first symptom. Then within 1 to 5 days comes painful sensations in the arms, hands, legs, and feet. There are other effects if you ingest thallium, including abnormal heart rhythms, burning sensations, coma, rapid heart rate, and high blood pressure, and of course, respiratory failure. Some severe effects include nerve damage to muscles that control the head and neck, or muscles that help you breathe, heart damage, and loss of hair. To treat ingested thallium poisoning today, doctors give an antidote called Prussian Blue. It was approved by the FDA in 2003. It is thought that Prussian Blue binds to thallium within the intestinal tract. Binding keeps the thallium within the tract, and it's not able to be absorbed. Anyone who ingests thallium should be administered Prussian Blue immediately. Then they will receive 4 daily doses after that. If Prussian Blue is not available, doctors will give up to 4 doses of activated charcoal, 1 dose every 2 to 3 hours. Activated charcoal is thought to bind to thallium within the intestinal tract, like Prussian Blue, but it's not as effective. Of course, if a medical professional gets to the poisoned person within 30 to 60 minutes, they will attempt to induce vomiting with Ipecac before they start giving activated charcoal or Prussian Blue. But in 1988, when Peggy Carr was poisoned, Prussian Blue hadn't yet been invented. I could not find if her doctors tried charcoal, but it may have been too late or had not been a proven treatment for thallium poisoning at that time. And it was indeed thallium in Peggy's system. After the doctors saw Peggy's hair falling out, they rushed a urine sample to a lab in Atlanta. The test results showed Peggy had 20,000 times the normal amount of thallium in a human body. Thallium is a naturally occurring element, so everyone has some small traces in their body. Dwayne and Travis were also tested for thallium poisoning, and they also had extremely high levels, though both boys would recover after months in the hospital, months of physical therapy, just to be able to move their arms, talk, and walk again. When the doctors told Pi that someone might have poisoned his family, Pi had remarked, "I don't think anyone dislikes us enough to do that." He could not have been more wrong. The doctors called the police anyway after Peggy Carr fell into a coma, and the police department went ahead and assigned a homicide detective to the case named Ernie Mincy. The family's water well was checked for contamination, but there was no sign. The detective started looking for people who would want to poison the cars. He quickly heard that Peggy and Pi had been having marital problems, but then he soon found out that the couple had reconciled. And when the detective went to the hospital to speak with Travis and Dwayne, he found Pi menacingly guarding Travis's hospital door. Even if he would poison his wife and stepson, would he really poison his own son? Hospital staff also remembered how tender he had been with his wife, and the detective also saw him at Peggy's bedside, gently holding her hand as tears fell silently down his cheeks. But to be sure, Pi's urine was tested, and he also had high levels of thallium in his body, though not lethal levels. Pi told them that his feet had also hurt and burned, but he had just thought it was from his work. He hadn't connected it to the suffering of his wife, son, and stepson. Sissy and 2-year-old Casey were tested, and they also had lower levels of thallium. I did not see where thallium was found in Tammy's system, though later, when the poisoner was indicted, her attempted murder was one of the charges. Investigators searched the car home to find the source of poison. More than 400 items were taken for testing. Empty Coke bottles, rat poison, homemade pickles, and more were sent to the lab. The test came back showing that there was thallium residue in the bottom of 4 empty Coke bottles. There were unopened bottles of Coke still in the car house, so investigators sent those bottles to the FBI lab at Quantico. It was found that the Coke bottle caps had been tampered with, and thallium was found in the contents of each bottle. After this discovery, FBI agent Brad Brecky then joined the investigation. Agent Brecky asked a member of the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit at Quantico, Bill Hagmeier, to come up with a psychological profile of the person poisoning the cars. Hagmeier's profile showed that the poisoner was most likely an intelligent white male in his 30s. This man, quote, liked to resolve conflicts without direct confrontation. According to Hagmeier, poisoners are, quote, usually outwardly passive and take pleasure watching death from a distance. The poisoner also most likely would have left a trail of threats. Agent Brecky and Detective Mincy found an anonymous letter left in July where the author said the cars needed to move out or else they would die. It read in all caps, quote, Pie Car, you and your so-called family have 2 weeks to move out of Florida forever, or else you will all die. This is no joke. Pie and some of his family chucked the letter up to being a teenager's prank. Peggy wasn't so sure. She told her kids to be careful. They also talked to Mark, Pie's ex-son-in-law, who was an initial suspect. And he told them that Tammy and her mother had gotten obscene phone calls. This was before Peggy and her kids even moved into the house. Tammy was called in by investigators and tearfully told them the details. Whoever was calling could tell the frightened women exactly what they were wearing and what they were doing. The call stopped when Margaret moved out, and Tammy got married, so they all blew it off. But it was obviously someone who could see the house. And the only people who could see their house, out in the middle of nowhere, was their next-door neighbors. George Trepal and his wife Diana Carr. She was no relation to Pie Carr. Her last name was just a coincidence. The police began to find more incidents with the neighbors. In March of 1988, Pie was trying to build another apartment, only it was partially on his neighbor's property. George Trepal complained to the zoning board, and Pie was cited by the county and stopped the construction. In October 1988, Diana got into an argument with Peggy. Diana had gone to the Carr residence to tell the Carr boys to turn their radio down. They were playing it too loud, she said. Peggy stood up for her sons, basically saying boys will be boys, and told Diana to get over it and mind her own business. Diana left shouting, "You won't get away with this." At the time, Peggy thought nothing of the threat except that their neighbors were assholes. This was only a week before she became sick. George also complained that the boys rode their motorcycles on his property, disturbing his lawn and driveway. Dwayne, Peggy's son, later said on the television show American Justice that they did basically torment him, meaning George. And there were other issues with the cars. The cars' dogs often chased the Trepal's cats. After one of these incidents, George threatened one of the Carr children by saying, "I'm going to kill you." After detectives found out about this, they asked Pie about the animals, and he remembered that one of his dogs had gotten sick and died, and he had thought at the time it was poison. The investigators were incredulous that he hadn't remembered this before. Pie said he had simply forgotten about the matter, and he wasn't sure anyway, but he tried to give a location to investigators where he had buried the dog so they could test the bones. They never found the buried dog, who had reportedly quickly gotten sick. His hair had fallen out, and he had died within a couple of days. Those symptoms were much like the cars, only at an elevated speed. So investigators were finally seeing the full picture. The cars had some obnoxious teenagers, sure, but George Trepal and his wife, Dr. Diana Carr, seemed to respond in very aggressive and menacing ways. Different members of the family remembered seeing George standing in his bedroom window, which had a full view of the Carr's pool, looking down at them with binoculars. The perfect spot for that obscene caller to have stood. Diana seemed much more openly aggressive, confronting Peggy and yelling at the kids. George might occasionally shout at the kids, but he never said anything to Peggy or Pi. He did avoid direct confrontation with adults. So who were these people? We all have asshole neighbors, and yeah, we can get into arguments, but when you add up all these stories, the Trepal seem especially combative and vindictive. George Trepal had been born in New York City in 1949 to a father who was a cop and a schoolteacher mother. They had thought they couldn't have kids after a couple of miscarriages, so Georgie was their pride and joy. Later investigations would reveal that George had been very coddled by his mother, perhaps molding his personality. He loved her. She took care of him. But he also felt that she held him back. He was a brilliant but lazy kid. After flunking out of one college, he got a degree in psychology and chemistry from the University of South Carolina. In 1975, George was arrested in Charlotte, South Carolina, after he was found operating a lab to make and sell amphetamines. George spent 3 years in a North Carolina federal prison. Thallium also happens to be a byproduct of amphetamine production. George tried for an early parole. He had been a model prisoner. But the investigators who put him away went before the parole board to explain that it had been a 6-year-long investigation to bring George to justice, and the amount of drugs they found were worth about $7 million on the street. This wasn't any small-time dealer. This was a serious drug organization. George had to serve his full sentence, and the Model Prisoner Act was dropped. He started writing memos to wardens, constantly complaining about other inmates breaking the rules. He became a general pain in the ass. He seemed to hate everyone around him. After he was released from prison, George became a member of Mensa, an organization for people with high IQs, enough to put them in the top 2% of the population. It was through Mensa that he met his wife, Diana. She was an orthopedic surgeon, and she was the breadwinner. George never really had a job, but claimed to write computer programs. Diana wrote her husband a check for $150 every now and then as an allowance. Their relationship was bizarre. Diana was often called domineering for her hot-headed temper. She appeared to bully her husband. But later investigations would reveal that it was much more complicated. But I'll get into that more later on. When investigators went to question George, they just casually asked if he knew why anyone would want to poison the cars. George straight up said he thought someone wanted the cars to move out of the neighborhood. Not only did this match the anonymous letter threat, there was no real neighborhood. There was the Carr house and the Trepal house, surrounded by orange groves. Detectives were sure they had their man. Not only his proximity to the cars, but his strange remarks, all the fighting, his degree in chemistry, and his criminal history all pointed to him as the poisoner. And he was just a strange little man. He didn't do anything to try and act innocent to the police. He didn't show nervousness, but nor did he show concern. It was more like the investigators were wasting his time. He was a busy man, he said. He always wore shorts and sandals with a t-shirt, and he wore Coke bottle glasses and had a scruffy beard. Diana, the doctor, dressed professionally and was a heavyset woman. They kind of looked like an odd couple, but yet they both seemed like snobbish nerds. A good match. After all, she was also a member of Mensa. As a doctor, she also had a degree in chemistry. Either one of them could have poisoned the Carr family, or they could have worked together. But investigators had no way to prove it. There was nothing linking Trepal or his wife to the crime except their odd behavior. But it was neighbor spats. This happens in neighborhoods all the time. it wasn't proof. They didn't have enough to get a search warrant for the Trepal home. Stymied, with no other options, in December of 1988, Polk County Detective Susan Gorick was asked to go undercover. She was supposed to watch George and look for evidence in his office and home trash cans. Susan was married to a police officer, a man who preferred the uniform and stayed in patrol. At first, after their marriage and first child, she was a stay-at-home mom. But she soon became intrigued and attracted to her husband's line of work. She went to the academy and got a job in Polk County. But she didn't like everyday police work on the streets. She loved a paper trail and quickly passed the test to make detective. And this wasn't her first undercover case, but it would be her most dangerous. She was scared and yet exhilarated to be chosen for this assignment. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. Researching true crime is about peeling back layers to uncover the mystery. That's what's fun about the puzzle game Best Fiends. Reaching a new level feels like uncovering a new layer in a story, one you get to take part in. I love that the longer I play it, the more challenging it becomes. Right now, I am completing levels to catch a bandit, which is a criminal slug, to get extra prizes. And I also upgraded Bob, one of my favorites, to level 10. Best Fiends has challenging puzzles, but still, it's casual enough for anyone to play, though it is designed for adults. I compete with my family and friends, and I can play whenever I have time, like when I'm drinking my morning coffee. And you can play it anywhere. That's one of the best parts. Best Fiends does not require the internet to play, and Best Fiends updates the game monthly with new levels and events, so it never gets old. This month, if you completed level 101, you got to become a road warrior. Best Fiends has thousands of levels already, with new levels, events, and characters added every month. It's hours of fun right at your fingertips, and you can even play offline. With over 100 million downloads and tons of five-star reviews, Best Fiends is a must-play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. Getting in shape is great for the upcoming swimsuit season, but that's not all it's about. It's about building healthier habits that you can stick to. It's also about practicing self-care so you can feel better about yourself, which is really personal. That's why Noom is so great. It's a program that adjusts to your lifestyle. Noom teaches you the psychology behind the decisions you make and helps you keep track of everything from workouts to logging your meals. Noom has one of the largest and most accurate food databases available, so you can track your meal habits, visualize portion sizes, and check calories at a glance. Noom is not a diet. It's a habit-changing solution that helps you develop a new relationship with food through personalized courses. Noom has given me the ability to make healthy choices more easily, taking the anxiety out of meal planning. And I love the ease of using the Noom app. It's just 10 minutes out of my day to help keep me on track, find new recipes, and connect with the Noom community. Aside from a personal goal specialist, there is a whole community of Noomers cheering you on, all in the palm of your hand. You don't have to change it all in one day. Small steps make big progress. Sign up for your trial today at Noom, Noom.com/Southern Fried. What do you have to lose? Visit Noom.com/Southern Fried to start your trial today. George and Diana were the coordinators for their Mensa group's invitation-only murder mystery weekends. They even advertised these weekends in local newspapers. George was known to study police manuals to better help himself with the murder mystery parties. He also said he was a crime scene procedure expert. However, Diana later claimed she was the one who wrote the plots for these parties. And this was Susan's in. She wrote a letter to George asking to participate in the murder mystery weekend, even though she wasn't a member of Mensa. And she used quite a few 50-cent words to impress George. I'm going to quote from her incredible book, Poison Mind, the letter she sent to George. Quote, "This letter is to request further information on the upcoming Mensa murder weekend. As I am considering moving my home to this quiescent county, I am compelled to find some type of stimulating entertainment. Though I am acquainted with a renowned Mensa organization, never before have I been involved in a lifestyle that would permit such endeavors. My background consists of years of dedicated service to my perfidious mate, who took his thriving career and moved upwards and onwards alone. A weekend filled with intrigue and intellect could be just what the doctor ordered. Sincerely, Sharon Sherry Gwynn. She had put quotation marks around just what the doctor ordered, perhaps a nod to Diana. And this letter would get to someone like George. At least that's what the behaviorist at the FBI thought. It appealed to his snobbish intellect, while also hinting that this Sherry had been subjected to an unhappy and maybe even abusive marriage. That might appeal to George's protective or manly side. And it worked. George responded almost immediately to her letter, welcoming her to the murder mystery weekend. It was held at the Winter Haven Holiday Inn in April of 1989. It was only 5 weeks after Peggy Carr had died. Susan was nervous, posing as Sherry, and she was afraid to eat. In her book, Poison Mind, she said she realized she was being silly, that they wouldn't poison an entire Mensa group. But in her long undercover investigation of George Trepal, she never really lost that fear. She was supposed to get close to George, not Diana. The FBI and Polk County investigators thought it more likely that George did the poisoning. And though she doesn't really discuss this in the book, I wondered about Diana and jealousy. From what Susan reported, Diana was really nice to her. She would call and ask for George, and Diana would hand over the phone or politely tell her he wasn't home, but where she could find him. I thought this was really strange. It's not that men can't have women for friends, even married men. But Susan's chosen role as Sherry made her a woman on the verge of divorce. She seemed needy and looked to George for comfort. She never tried to make friends with Diana, but it didn't seem that Diana ever minded the situation. And I'm sorry, as evolved as I feel, and as much as I trust my husband, some new woman coming into his life constantly calling him would definitely get to me. It speaks to the extremely odd relationship George and Diana had. Susan, posing as Sherry, often went over to George's at his invitation. He showed her around his house, even opening a closet filled with bondage toys, whips, chains, ball gags, and such. He didn't seem the least bit embarrassed, but maybe like he was watching Sherry for a reaction. She didn't give him one. At his house, she saw a copy of Agatha Christie's novel, The Pale Horse, a book in which the murderer uses thallium to poison the victims. In fact, Susan's undercover work in the case was called Operation Pale Horse. Susan said she would often invite George to lunch, choosing the restaurant and getting there early so she could watch him and her food carefully. She noted that George always ordered a Coca-Cola for himself. She even invited him for a picnic late in the investigation when she was really starting to get worried, so she could make the food herself. She brought along a cooler with several different types of soda. George again chose a Coke. And she really played up the problems with her soon-to-be ex-husband. She hinted at violence in her marriage, and at one point she had her FBI agent contact, Brad Brecky, play her ex-husband in front of George at the airport. She told George she had to pick him up from the airport and wanted George to ride along to make her feel safer. But when her fake husband came down the escalator, he looked at Susan, who realized that George had disappeared. She threw the agent a look that told him to make it look good anyway. The agent grabbed her arm, and they looked as though they were arguing. And they were under surveillance by other agents. After George ducked out of the airport, a female agent came out from behind a pole laughing. She had been stationed there to watch and was startled when George jumped in behind her. Their profile of George had been pretty spot on. He did not like direct confrontation. But no matter how much Susan tried to subtly prompt him into talking about poison, George never really did. Though he did one time mention to her laughingly that he heard FTD sends poison flowers. The investigation went on for months without any breakthroughs. Not only was Susan becoming weary, it was taking a toll on her family life. Her husband had always been understanding, but she had never been undercover that long before. And he had no idea she was investigating a poisoner for many months into the investigation. A man that could kill her just by slipping something into her drink. He was very upset when he found out what her assignment was. And at the Polk County Department, she felt whispers that her colleagues and boss were losing faith in her. Though she soon found she was wrong about her boss, she had his and the FBI's support throughout her ordeal. And yet, in later months, she never had as much surveillance and protection. Sometimes it was just a wire hidden in her purse. That was what really enraged her husband. Susan was risking her life, and it was like her department had abandoned her. In her ruse with George, Susan kept telling him that her soon-to-be ex wouldn't sign the divorce papers because they were still fighting over a condo they owned. If she gave up her rights, he would sign. That became the break she needed. In November of 1989, George and Diana moved to Sebring, Florida. He told Susan that Diana was moving her practice, though Susan wondered if he was aware he was under suspicion. If he was so damned smart, how could he not realize it? But as the saying goes, sometimes you can't see the forest for the trees. And Susan was the trees. George offered his house in Alturas to Susan to stay at when he and his wife moved. She insisted on paying their rent and utilities, and he shrugged as if it didn't really matter. But it was important that she officially rented the house, because then she could consent to a search. Otherwise, investigators would have to get a warrant, and George might have time to remove anything incriminating. But oddly, he let her pay him the rent money, but would not turn over a key. He claimed no one locked their doors in Alturas, and she needn't worry. He never mentioned the poisonings next door to his friend Sherry. On December 12th, Susan moved into the house. Immediately, crime scene technicians went through the home looking for evidence. They swabbed floors, insides of cabinets, sink drains, and more. They searched George's secret room. He had shown it to Susan before. It was filled with more sex toys and odd science books and mystery novels. He and Diana were both obsessed with murder mysteries. They searched the garage where they found a dishpan with small bottles. The bottles were swabbed, and then the swabs were sent to the FBI lab in Virginia. There were no Coke bottles like the ones found at the car house, but there was a bottle capping machine in the garage. A brown, unlabeled bottle was found sitting on a workbench. It would eventually be identified as thallium. But as January came around, investigators hadn't heard anything back from the FBI lab. This was right around the time that several judges and other officials around the country began receiving strange envelopes with white powder. This preceded the anthrax powder mailings after 9/11, but it was also when Unabomber Ted Kaczynski was still terrorizing Americans. The FBI had their hands full, and the Trepal investigation was not considered urgent. Susan came up with a good idea. She wanted to meet with George and tell him that police came by asking about him and the poisoning. In late January 1990, Susan called George and said she had something important she wanted to tell him. They met at a Sebring McDonald's. Susan was wearing a wire. She told George that two detectives came by the rental house and told her what happened to the Carr family. She handed George two business cards, Detective Mincy's and Agent Brecky's. George had seen these two cards before when he was questioned by the detective and the agent, and he had thrown them away. As a kick, Mincy said, "Why don't you give him the actual cards he threw away?" Remember, Susan had to search his trash early in the investigation, and she had found them. Once George saw the business cards, Susan said he started acting out of character. He told her to be quiet. Then he stammered and said, quote, "I hope I'm not a prime suspect. That could be messy." While this looked bad, it was still not enough evidence to arrest George. Susan was getting impatient and more worried by the day. She had written a letter resigning officially from the Trepal investigation, saying she wanted to focus on her other cases. The same day she wrote that letter, Agent Brad Brecky called her with the good news. The FBI found traces of thallium in the bottles found in George's garage. Now they had him. On April 7, 1990, Susan, Agent Brecky, and Detective Mincy met with Polk County sheriffs near George's new house in Sebring. Susan, still acting as her alias Sherry, called George and kept him on the phone while FBI agents and police officers swooped in. Diana answered the door, and Detective Mincy and Agent Brecky said they wanted to talk to George. Diana asked what for. George heard them and then told Susan the police were there and he would have to call her back. Diana was pissed that the police were at her door. She made a huge scene. She started cussing at the officers and blocking the door with her body. While the male officers were hesitant to restrain Diana, a female lieutenant, Ernie Mincy's boss in fact, charged up and slammed Diana to the ground. I just love the badass women in this case. As officers entered the house, they saw George at the top of the stairs in his underwear, blue bikini briefs. He turned the corner and Mincy and Brecky were running up the stairs, worried he might grab a gun if out of their sight. But George was just calmly getting dressed. Once he was downstairs, George was told he was under arrest for the murder of Peggy Carr. He immediately requested an attorney. Police escorted George and Diana out of the house and then started their search. They found a police manual with a chapter called Death by Poison and a book called Poison Detection in Human Organs. Susan told police they needed to see if George had a secret room like he did in the Alturas house. They found the secret room, and it was like something straight out of a movie. They couldn't find it at first, and finally one technician noticed that a wall was thicker than others with a shelf in front of it. As they pried it open, they found the new secret room where there was a partially completed wooden platform the size of a bed with manacles attached. All the windows had been taken out and the room had been soundproofed. It looked like a torture chamber. In her book, Poison Mind, Susan said that it went through her mind that he might have been planning to lock her in that room. And she still wasn't satisfied that she understood the dynamic of George and Diana. She walked through the house, shaking books open, and soon a letter fell out of one. It was one that George had written to Diana in the early 80s, when they had not been married that long. I cannot quote this entire letter because it fills more than 3 pages in the book, but it revealed something surprising to Susan and investigators. While Diana had always seemed to be the dominant partner, giving George an allowance and showing more aggression towards the neighbors, George was actually the dominant partner in their relationship. This long typewritten letter was reprimanding his wife on the behavior he hated from her. Namely, her habit of speaking in baby talk. He wrote, quote, "I do not like children, and I feel like I'm raping a child." He also said that his mother told him children with bad grammar had a special label, retarded. He wrote, quote, "I have no wish to fuck a retarded child. However, I do want to make love with an adult." He complained that when they role-played during sex, that she used the same old lines and themes, suggesting that she should watch porn or read some novels to get new ideas. He insisted that he always had to have her full attention at all times. Specifically, he whined that his wife would open the mail when she came home from work instead of immediately paying attention to him. And this dude used the caps lock a lot. He complained that she wasn't always immediately interested in sex whenever he wanted it. His needs were not being met. He insisted that she become more compliant and more spontaneous. Quote, "Dress in something sexy and meet me at the door when I come in. Try to rape me." I mean, this letter goes on and on, giving Diana specific books to study like The Joy of Sex. He ended it by reminding her that he enjoyed fantasies, but he bored easily. During Susan's investigation, George had mostly fit in the profile the FBI had given her. He once smashed a Christmas tree angrily, and one time had poisoned Diana's dog. but he was never overtly violent or aggressive to his wife, though some of her colleagues claim to have seen bruises. I think it's possible those were from the S&M and bondage the couple engaged in. George didn't beat his wife, but he was emotionally domineering. But from the secret rooms, the bondage toys and other items found in the house, it was clear the couple was into sadomasochism and bondage. I am in no way kink-shaming George and Diana. Sexual proclivities between consenting adults is no one's business. But finding out that George was the dom and Diana was the sub was very enlightening to Susan in the investigation. She finally understood George. He didn't like his wife's baby talk because he was attracted to her strong, assertive personality. But he also whined about her meeting his needs. Susan said, quote, "He wanted Diana to be strong, meet his needs, but to be his mother." And Diana kept being strong for her husband for a while. Once, when going for a usual meeting with him at the jail before trial, she became angered at a female officer who had to search her. She cussed at the woman and then roughly grabbed the officer's breasts. A supervisor intervened, and Diana was led to another room where she calmed down and apologized. A normal woman would realize she had gotten off lucky. She had just assaulted an officer. But not Diana. She had her lawyer send a letter addressed to the sheriff of the Polk County Jail claiming that the female officer who had searched her had squeezed her breasts. The letter asked for the sheriff's assurance that Dr. Carr would be treated with respect on future visits. Instead, the lawyer received a hand-delivered letter 3 days later from the sheriff that Diana was not allowed to visit her husband until further notice. 3 weeks later, she was charged with battery of a law enforcement officer. It was a third-degree felony that she eventually pled down, getting probation. But it shows that Diana was just as conceited and sure of herself as her husband was. She thought she could send a haughty letter from her lawyer and get that officer in trouble. Instead, she found herself being charged. They really were the strangest couple. Both considered themselves superior to others and above the law. When Susan went to see George at the jail and introduced herself as Detective Susan Gorick, she said his face didn't even change. He remained polite and smiling. As she walked out, he told her to have a nice day. She was flabbergasted. Usually, when she revealed her identity to a target, they became enraged. That's what she had been hoping for, that George's facade would slip. But it didn't. Even later in court, he would mouth nice things to her like, "Hi," and "Have a good day." He was so weird. George's trial began on January 15, 1991. The prosecution said George was a diabolical killer who thought he was smarter than the police. The defense said the prosecution's case was circumstantial. They said there was enough evidence proving Diana was the poisoner as there was to prove George was. And this was in direct contradiction to what their client wanted. George did not want them to accuse his wife. Diana took the stand, but the prosecutor used kid gloves with her. Susan Gorick explained that he was worried she would stand up in court and proclaim that she had poisoned the cars, wrecking the case against George and tainting a retrial. On February 5, 1991, after 6 hours of deliberation, George was found guilty of first-degree murder and 15 other counts, 6 counts of attempted first-degree murder, 7 counts of poisoning food or water, and 1 count of tampering with a consumer product. One juror said, "When we announced him guilty, he looked at the jury and he smirked. There were jurors in tears over this, and he just smirked at us." On March 6, 1991, jurors recommended the death penalty in a 9-3 vote. George was sentenced to death for murder and 30 years each for all other charges. In his many appeals, the lab testing by the FBI was questioned, so the tests were repeatedly performed independently of the FBI lab, and they always got the same results. Diana Carr divorced George in 1996. In 2017, Florida changed their laws regarding the death penalty. They no longer allowed non-unanimous juries to recommend death. A judge could only impose a death sentence if everyone on the jury voted for death. But it was too late for George. His fate was sealed. But he has not yet been executed. Two people were executed in Florida in 2019, and none so far in 2020. There are currently 347 people on death row in Florida. George Trepal is not on the list for 2020 scheduled executions. In her novel, The Pale Horse, Agatha Christie wrote, "Evil is not something superhuman. It's something less than human. Your criminal is someone who wants to be important, but who will never be important because he will always be less than a man." Damn straight, Miss Christie. And it is even more poetic to me that the cowardly poisoner, who was indeed less than a man, was brought down by a courageous female undercover detective. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Thank you so much to Haley Gray for her research assistance in this case. And I definitely recommend reading Poison Mind, The True Story of the Mensa Murderer and the Policewoman Who Risked Her Life to Bring Him to Justice. It is written by the undercover detective, Susan Gorick, with the help of writer, Jeffrey Good. And it doesn't read like many true crime books. She doesn't tell the story in first person. It reads like a screenplay and would make a fantastic movie. I definitely recommend reading it if you have the chance. And thank you to Amy McKnight for suggesting this case. As I said in the beginning, I know some states are opening back up, but do what you can to keep yourself safe. I hope everyone uses common sense and still practices social distancing as much as possible. Again, thank you so much to our essential and frontline healthcare workers. I am so grateful for everyone from grocery workers to healthcare workers and all those in between. And if you are still in quarantine, keep the faith. We will get through this. If you're bored, come join my Facebook group. It's not all grim true crime. We share memes and have a lot of laughs. It's a lovely community, and we would love to have you. And please, if you're suffering abuse in quarantine or having suicidal thoughts, please look at today's show notes for resources. You are not alone. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I'm sorry, but I no longer answer private messages on social media. I manage three platforms, and it's just too overwhelming. But please, feel free to reach out by email. Not only do I get my most interesting and little-known cases from listener suggestions, I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Wash your hands, stop touching your face, and y'all take care.